Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2015. Lecture 7, delivered on February 3, 2015. The title of this lecture is Financial Statement Analysis.
Today, financial statement analysis. One of the bread and butter, meat and potatoes subjects of finance. What we do when we haven't got any alcohol to drink. I can't guarantee you that I will turn you into investment gurus, but I am going to teach you about financial analysis as an external observer of a corporation, making decisions about should we invest in this stock, should we hold back, what kind of recommendations should we make to a client who comes in and talks to us. For your purposes, you're going to do some investment, and we'll talk more about investment in the long run. But for today, we're going to talk about financial analysis, looking at financial statements. But I'm also going to take you past the technical analysis. There are two kinds of financial analysis. There's technical analysis. We call the people who do technical analysis, in other words, numbers, calculating ratios, and then looking at charts and all that, we call them the elves, E-L-V-E-S. And they don't look as good as the elves in The Hobbit. They're ugly. And then there are the other breed, the fundamental analysts. We, and note I'm using myself in that one, look at the numbers, but then we go past the numbers. And we ask the important questions. Why? What if? How much? Who farted? We ask the important questions. I'll walk into a store of a corporation, and I'll look around the store, and I'll say, what am I seeing here? So, for example, you'd hear someone raving about a store, a company like Walmart. I'll walk into the store and I'll look on the shelves. Wait a minute, they're missing stock out on this shelf, stock out on that shelf. I don't see a whole lot of people around here. Why don't they have this? They have always had it before, but now that shelf is empty. Okay, I ask myself questions, why would this company look like this? Sometimes a company that's suffering and everyone says it's about to die, a fundamental analyst would go in and see for himself. Never mind the numbers. Let's look at the management. Let's look at anything that's changed. Is the company trying to come back? What is it doing to come back? And sometimes we'll make a recommendation or a judgment contrary to what the popular opinion of the elves is. To get to that, though, I want to show you how to look at stock in a more general sense before we dig into financial statements. And also, as a warning, I'm going to pull up the real financial statements of a corporation, and we're going to look at them, and it's worth it for you to know how to do this for this company because this might show up on a quiz or an exam, the same company, for financial analysis. Hint, hint. Nudge, nudge. Wink, wink. Okay, so it's worth it for you to pay attention to the companies. And I'm going to show you what these numbers mean, some of the basic numbers that we can look at. And for this, woman, are you a French wine connoisseur, you know, Chateau Neuf de Derrière, or are you Earl's grapes from Lombard, New York? Which one are you? Yeah, sure. I mean, we all love French wine. Not all of us. Some of us don't care. We can't tell the taste anyway. But you see, the thing is that usually we'll go to very reputable resources to find out what we need to find out. But sometimes we'll just grab what's there, what's quick to get at. I draw the line at Wikistupedia. I won't go there, but I'll come close sometimes. So even though I know better places to go, on the fly, trying to get something to show you here, I will go to Yahoo Finance. And I'm going to pull up a company and say, oh, let's have a look at its basic numbers. You just type in the name of a company and type in stock quote after that, and you'll get a nice top hit that'll show you some of the important numbers. So without further ado, here's Netflix. Netflix was in the news, I think it was actually yesterday. Apple and Netflix both made big, announced big new issues of bonds. In other words, they're both going to borrow a ton of money. Apple, $4.5 billion. Netflix, about $1.5 billion. They're going to borrow a wad of money. So obviously, they're in trouble. They need to borrow money. Well, that's not true. There are a couple of reasons why companies borrow money when they don't need money. You ever notice that when you don't need money, your credit's really good, that's when you can borrow money? But anyway, Netflix, previous close is at $441.07. That is an expensive stock. In other words, to buy a round lot. Now, when I say a round lot, that means 100 shares. A round lot is 100 shares, would cost you north of $44,107. And I say north because you'd pay a commission. So you not only have to beat $441.07 on the gain, but you also have to gain enough to cover that commission to buy that much. So this is not your typical stock that you would buy with the change in your pocket. But let's talk about it anyway. That previous close means that's what it closed at yesterday. Right now, it's at $456.92. It's up $15.86 off the close from yesterday. That means nothing. All we care about is a percentage gain or loss. Anything in finance, and I'll show you how to calculate percentage changes. That's absolutely important for everything we're going to do as far as financial analysis, for a lot of things we're going to do for financial analysis. But anyway, it's up 3.5%, better than 3.5%. So in other words, the market is seeing this debt issue announcement as favorable, or at least something is more favorable than the negatives, because the stock price is up 3.5% from yesterday's close. If you bought it at yesterday's close, you probably would have been able to sell it and cover your commission and make a few bucks off it if you had $44,107. By the way, if you don't buy a round lot or a multiple of round lots, you would be buying something called an odd lot. An odd lot is when I buy a couple of shares, 50 shares, 80 shares. That's an odd lot. You typically buy in round lots, but you can buy an odd lot. It's really stupid, though. Buying one share of stock to give to your cousin for his graduation, that's about the stupidest thing you can do, in the sense that you're going to pay an enormous commission for some stock that'll probably never rise over that commission. Well, maybe it will. You never know. Okay. Now, if we look at this for a few minutes, we have a previous close of $441.07. On the opening, it was $443.24, which means that overnight there was buying pressure so that on the bell, the stock price just popped immediately because there was buying pressure. That would probably be because of the knowledge or the suspicion that an announcement of a debt issue was going to be made by Netflix. Bid and ask. When you sell a stock, you sell it for less than when you buy a stock. The bid and the ask spread is not all that much, but it's enough that it will annoy you. In this case, it's about 55 cents, it looks like. Yeah, 55 cents. So when you sell that stock, you're going to sell it for about $456.43. If you buy that stock, you're going to buy it for $456.98. Notice that well, that's interesting. It's closer to the ask right now, the settle is. We sometimes say that number in the middle there, the top number is the settlement, or maybe the average. Okay. Now the next number there is beta, We're going to do a lot with beta later in the course, but as I've told you before, I like to introduce things and do it in layers so that by the time I do it formally, you're actually kind of comfortable with the concept. The beta of a stock measures its non-diversifiable risk in a market portfolio. In other words, this is how risky the stock is if you are investing properly. It's a measure of the volatility that you can't get rid of. Now, the actual volatility of the stock could be a lot more. The beta is saying, if you're not stupid, this is how much risk you're going to bear buying this stock and putting it into a well-diversified portfolio. Know this. The pivot number is 1.00. That is the risk of the market portfolio. In other words, if you were to invest and track the market, buy every stock in the economy in its weight, proportional weight to the in the economy, if you had a true, pure market portfolio, its beta would be 1.00. So in other words, this is a number that tells you how far out or in from a pure market portfolio you are taking risk. So in other words, Netflix is riskier than the market. Therefore, you should expect, not necessarily get, but you should expect a higher return than you would get from holding just a pure market portfolio. Now, by the way, there's another pivot number too. Zero, a beta of zero, would be a pure riskless instrument. A short-term treasury bill would be have a beta of zero. That doesn't mean that treasury bills don't have price volatility. They do. But in a well-diversified portfolio, the residual volatility is zero. So know those two, and I always ask this. I'll tell you right now, I always do this on an exam, some kind of multiple choice question of some kind, maybe even an essay question about, well, which of these is the risk of the market portfolio? Or what does it mean for a stock to have a beta of 1.5? If you have a stock with a beta of 1.5, well, let's do this one. A beta of 1.43, the way you interpret that is that in a well-diversified portfolio, this stock has 143% of the risk of the market portfolio. Again, in a well-diversified portfolio, Netflix stock has 143% of the risk of the market portfolio. In other words, it's riskier than the market. So if you're a risk taker, you would form your portfolio, a well-diversified portfolio, of stocks with betas above one. And their weighted average in the portfolio would form the beta of the portfolio. This is actually a fairly risky stock. 1.43 is a little bit up there. If you're a conservative investor, you don't want to take a butt bath. You would probably form a portfolio of stocks that have betas below 1, 0.8, 0.6, 0.7. And then those would form a portfolio that had a lower risk, and therefore a lower expected return than the market portfolio. It's a very good, quick way to see just a kind of a relative risk measure of this stock. And as I said, Netflix is actually a little bit surprisingly risky stock. You're going to see why when we do the financial statements. Go.
What's a high beta? Like, what does it go to, 4 or 5?
When you get to about 2, that's when your nose starts to bleed. That's when my back leg starts going up and down. You get to betas of 3, 4, 5. Well, I don't know. That's one of those things where you're the kind of person who likes to eat blasting caps and see what happens to your teeth. There was an old saying back in Kentucky in my time, might be right for some, but it's not for us Bufords. That's scary territory. Here's a cool thing, though. The bottom, I mean, theoretically, you could have an infinite beta, but usually you see that 1 as your fulcrum. And then 0 is a dead, riskless. But there are stocks that have betas that are negative. they actually run contrary to the market. They are gold mining stocks. There are gold mining stocks. You can even buy mutual funds that are formed from companies whose stocks are negative. Now, they're not huge negatives. They're like 0.4, 0.2, negative 0.5, but they're negative. They're contrarian stocks. In other words, when the market is going up, you think it's going to go down, so you go for these. There's an old saying. The term flight to quality means that investors are getting out of riskier stuff and going to safer stuff. So we would say that when investors are selling stock and going to bonds, that's a flight to quality. So the old saying goes, from stocks to bonds to gold, from gold to bullets. Okay? So let's hope we stop with the bonds. But there are contrarian stocks. So if you're one of those SOBs who everything they tell you is a lie, the economy is about to go to hell in a handbasket, you might think about forming a portfolio or buying into a mutual fund that had was that comprised stocks with negative betas. They're out there. And they're gold mining stocks for the most part. Although I had someone who was listening to my Apple iTunes podcast last semester, not a student or anything, I don't know why he was listening to it. He sent me and he showed me a couple of stocks that weren't gold mining stocks, but they still had slightly negative betas. Still trying to figure those out. But anyway. Okay, now the earnings date. They will say when their next earnings are on April the 20th to the 24th, sometime in that time period. What that does for you as an investor is it gives you something mark on my calendar, because as it runs up to that date, there's going to be a lot of speculation. Are they going to report good earnings, bad earnings? Are their earnings going to exceed their projections? Are they going to fall below their projections? So this gives you a chance to roll the dice. Okay, I think their earnings are going to be better than they projected. So I would lean into the stock, because if that actually happened, investors would go bananas. But you might also say, oh, I think they were being awfully optimistic in projecting their first quarter earnings. So I think I'm going to short the stock, because I'll bet they're going to say that the earnings didn't meet their projections. Now, if that's the case, what's going to happen is the big boys are going to sell the hell out of that stock, and you've shorted it, so you make money on the short. It's your call. It's just something that you can keep in mind if you want to play lucky. Days range, that just tells you the... Wow. I want you to look at something there. That is actually a wide range. You see that range on where it's low and high for the day? Do you notice that? That's actually kind of a nice little spread there. And notice that the thing is a buck and a half, buck and change off its high for the day. So in other words, investors surged in, and then some of them began to say, I'm getting a little too optimistic. So they sold back out. So you had the up, and now you've got the down. It's still up from the close yesterday, but it looks like it came off its high, and it probably isn't going to, well, actually, it should be done for the day. Yeah, it's done for the day. So it came off its high for the day. There was probably some profit taking. Investors bought in, and then towards the end of the trading day, they sold back out to cash in a little of their money on it. That's how you interpret that. Notice that there was actually a drop for a while below the close yesterday. That would probably be some profit takers rolling in, trying to scare run everyone out by selling hard to drive the price down so that they could buy it at a cheaper price to bring it back up. I'm talking to you here now like a technical analyst would. I'm showing you how we think about these things. Okay, now, the range. Notice that in the range, well, what do you notice about the 52-week range? What do you see? Is it closer to the high or to the low? Good. That's one of the things you look at. Okay, this stock seems to be doing a lot better now than it was sometime in the last 52 weeks. This stock was below 300. So now it's at 456.92 close on the day. that means that this stock has been doing pretty good. And as you can see from the 52, from the chart, even for today, it's been doing pretty darn good. Matter of fact, let me see if I can pull the 1 year up here, just so you can see the 1 year. Whoa, look at that. That, my good people, is volatility. That's a roller coaster. But remember, that's not your volatility. If you're stupid and you buy just this stock, that's the risk you are bearing. A roller coaster like those idiotic, insane things that they have, like the one that's 4G's guaranteed to kill small children who get on it by snapping their necks, that's what you would get if you bought this stock raw. If it's in a well-diversified portfolio, the residual risk that you bear, the systematic risk, the non-diversifiable risk component, is only some of that, not all of that. So when you look at that whipsaw up and down on that, that's what happens if you don't diversify your portfolio. Okay? But even at that, though, I mean, this is actually pretty, look at that thing. Wow, do you see that plummet down there? That's what we call yeehaw. Okay, no. Let me back up there. That's actually kind of scary to me. Okay, now, the volume. You have to look at this one relative to other stocks. You also have to look at this one relative to its recent history of volume. Is there a surge in volume? That would tell you that this stock is getting a lot of interest. Maybe good, maybe bad. If this volume has been there for a long time, that means that there's nothing, there's no new players, there's no new activity. Notice how you have to think of everything in context. And nothing is, well, okay, bankruptcy, that would be a game changer. But nothing in a normal company is an awesome thing. P/E ratio. Price to earnings. This is one of the ratios I'm going to teach you today and on Tuesday. The P/E ratio is the price to earnings per share on each. So in other words, at the net income line, that's the money that belongs to the shareholders. Divide that net income by the number of shareholders, and you get the earnings per share, EPS. Now, the price of the stock, that's how much, if you do P/E, the number is how many dollars you're willing to pay today for $1 of that company's recent earnings per share. In this case, for every dollar that Netflix just earned that belongs to the shareholders, new shareholders are willing to pay $105. That P/E ratio is way high. That is a clear message that this is a risky as hell stock. The beta, 1.43, that tells me there's risk. But a P/E ratio of 105.77, in other words, you are willing, $456.92 is what you're paying for. That would mean that this company earned per share for the shareholders about $1.15 or something like that. But new buyers are willing to pay $105.77 to claim $1 of current earnings, because they think that $1 of current earnings is ultimately, as a present value, going to be worth $105.77 in new shareholder earnings. Now, I'm saying this a lot of different ways, hoping that one of them kind of catches your mind. This is an awful... I can ask this as an essay question on a first exam or even on a final. Don't try to get too fancy with your answer to this because it can get really foggy. The best way to explain price-earnings ratio, it is how much new investors are willing to pay for each $1 the company has recently earned. For each $1 the company has recently earned. The why of that is the deeper one. It's the investors, the global world of investors think that every dollar that was the shareholders at the bottom line after they paid their bills and all that, that every $1 of net income per shareholder is going to create $105.77 in present value for future earnings for the shareholders. Now that, good people, is a real long bet. How many investments do you know, woman, how many investments do you know that you can put a dollar in and get $105 back? You know what we call those? You know what comes to my mind? Lottery tickets, the ones that come out of the machine. Ka-chunk, a dollar, you won $100. Bull crap, I've never won $100. They lie. Same thing there. That's a lottery ticket. 105 P.E. ratio of 105.77, that's a lottery ticket. Matter of fact, I can buy one of those ones that give promise to you $20,000 a week for life. Yeah, I want that one. I'm going to buy those suckers. But, I mean, your chance of spending a dollar on a lottery ticket, that's the kinds of promises those things make. Normally, P.E. ratios, just on a normal basis, you'd probably see P.E. ratios in a range of anywhere, low risk, 5, kind of getting a little scary, 15, 25, really, really scary, 50, 105, 77, wow. So again, when you're measuring risk, don't look at one number. Look at several numbers and also look inside yourself for what you see and what your tolerance for risk is. What I'm seeing here is Netflix is a great buy if you are a real risk taker. But if you've got money that you actually want to, you know, like eat with, that's probably not this kind of a stock you would want to do. Okay, EPS, earnings per share was $4.32. In other words, net income divided by shares outstanding. Now, they have two of these. There's one that they usually report, and then there's another one you'll see sometimes called fully diluted. There's a number of common stock shares that are outstanding, but there's also some common stock shares that could become outstanding because executives have options and things like that. So if you see diluted, that means that they're adding in those potential extra common shares in the denominator. So the fully diluted would be a little bit lower than the EPS that's typically reported. Now, the dividend and yield. This Netflix doesn't pay a dividend. So in other words, it's pure, every dollar they're earning, they're plowing back into the company. The plowback ratio is 100%. The dividend ratio is 0%. This company isn't paying a dividend. In other words, this company says, we can make more for you by keeping your money, shareholders, than you can by getting this money in a dividend check. It's a young, high-risk corporation that way. Because everything you throw into that is going to, it's got to be on the company's growth in the stock price. There's none of that that's going to come back to you. Now, the dividend yield, if it were there, it would be what the dividend is divided by the price. It's basically like the yield on your savings account or your checking account. In other words, you paid $100 for a share of stock, you get a $2 a share dividend, the dividend yield would be 2%. Essentially, you're getting 2% back that you know you're going to get back for the $100 you put in. In this case, there wouldn't be any dividend yield because there's no dividend. So if this company gave out, let's say, a $5 dividend, you would do $5 divided by 456.92. That's how you would do it. But this company has no dividend, no dividend yield. That is Netflix in a nutshell. Doesn't hurt to do this. This is how you start looking at stocks. You start thinking about stocks, and it makes you look really intelligent. So that the next time you go to the stock market singles bar, you know, and you're sitting there, and this very attractive person sits down next to you, and you know everything about Netflix. You say, well, yes, I'm a little concerned with that P.E. ratio at 105.77. You say things like that, you will breed that night. Bro. Know your stuff. It's actually, you will find out that people, when they find out, well, you've taken a finance course, you're a business major, you might get hit with these people who try to sell you stuff, investment products, or your friends might say, well, I heard about this stock, what do you think of that? You can talk intelligently to them from a base of knowledge. Even if you don't know the company, you can get a very quick snapshot. And as you do this more, which I want all of you to be able to do, regardless of what your major is, it gives you a sense of control. Whether or not you have control, that's obviously you don't. None of us do. But it gives you a sense of knowledge control so that you don't have to depend entirely on supposed experts, because experts can be wrong. And sometimes it's not that they're wrong. They're just wrong for you, for what you want to accomplish. So without further ado, I'm going to take you to the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC.gov. Now, there are a lot of places where you can get the financial statements of a company. Almost always, they are pulling from the SEC's database. That's what they're almost always doing. God, that scares me when I see those SEC things. I'm out of that world now. But to give you the background of this very quickly so that you understand, if you are a public corporation, by securities, federal securities law, you must report on a regular basis a pile of information. If you want to go public, you start that process, and once you have begun it, you are in that process forever unless you go through the ungodly process of going back private. Specifically, once you're a public company, you must file financial reporting information on Form 10-K. That's an annual report. It's literally, I used to write these 10-Ks for companies. That was one of the ways I made money. And then it became illegal for me to do it because only lawyers could do it. But back in the day, I did it. They are hundreds of pages long. They contain incredible amounts of information that the analysts all over the world pour through for hints and ideas about what the company is up to. They include audited financial statements so that an outside accounting firm has said, these financial statements were prepared in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles, consistently applied, that whole thing. They contain tons of other information, exhibits. They must be filed with the SEC. And quarterly versions called 10-Q must be filed. So essentially, the 10-Qs are like the preliminaries on each quarter that culminate in the 10-K at the end of the company's fiscal year. Now remember, I don't know if you know this or not, but not every company has a fiscal year that ends on the calendar year. As a matter of fact, it just annoys the hell out of me that what was the company I ran into last year? Its fiscal 2014 ended in February of 2013. I mean, they're all over the board. So just because you're seeing a 10-K doesn't mean it's a very recent information. Netflix is blissfully normal this way, though. Okay, Form 10-Q, the quarterlies. The 10-K, they're the annual reports on the financial condition of the company. Then there are other forms that are going to be available to you through the SEC. Companies have to file information products of various kinds. Insider trading has to be reported. In other words, if the CEO's got a pile of stock and he wants to sell some of it so that he can buy a third mansion, that would be on a report. A company that is buying more than a little bit of stock in another company must let the SEC know what it's up to. But there is one other one that's kind of important that would be worth you keeping your eye on. And I'll ask you this, I might ask you this on a quiz or a test. It's the Form 8K. It's a report of a non-recurring event. These are things like our president resigned. It's non-recurring, but you have to file a Form 8K for this happening. You might file a Form 8K if there were some, we have learned of a significant lawsuit that has been filed against the company. You would file a report on 8K. Always err on the side of conservative. This was one of the great ways that I made money as a consultant, because I consulted for a lot of small-time companies that were kind of shady. And what they try to do is a scam called pump and dump, where they'd release some press release that said glowing things about the company that would induce investors to buy hard into the company to push the stock price up, and then the insiders would sell some of their stock through dirty channels at high prices to make some money. But every time a press release comes out, there has to be a Form 8K on it. So they would never tell me in advance, but they say, yeah, we just released an 8K. We just did a press release this morning telling about this new technology we've discovered from aliens. Oh, okay, I'll prepare the 8K. That's $50. And they're easy. Okay, now, what? Is that too much? Too little. Back in the 80s? Are you nuts? $50 was a lot back in the 80s. We had a lot of things you don't have back in the 80s. Do you know that we didn't even have PowerPoints? We had stone tablets. The grad assistant held up the stone tablets. Yeah. You know these integers you guys work with? We didn't have them. We had zeros and ones. Sometimes we didn't have the ones, but we made do. You can do a lot with zeros in coding. Sorry. Bad flashback. Damn. What the hell was I? Shut the hell off your face. You know, but the thing is that it used to be everything was on paper. Everything was on paper. But then, starting in the 1980s, the Securities and Exchange Commission began to make it so that you could file electronically through a system called EDGAR, E-D-G-A-R. Now, back then, EDGAR was an incredibly complicated thing. You could file a Form 10K on EDGAR, and everything is structured. You got your headers, your name, your address, your phone number, this part, that part. So everything, if you did it through EDGAR, you had to put these tags around each header tag, slash header tag. It was like a super version of HTML. In fact, it was SGML. A standard generalized markup language. The HTML you might be familiar with web pages is actually just a baby version of that super hard monster system that existed before the internet. Well, I got a license to be an EDGAR filing agent so that I could do form filings for companies in EDGAR. And once I figured out how to write the code, it was easy. That's why an 8K for me was 2 minutes. For $50, yeah, I'll do that. And then I'd make it look like it was a real hard thing. Well, the EDGAR system developed over the years to a much more subtler, and it became required of all companies that they had to do it this way. And finally, they told people like me, small EDGAR filing agents, you can't do it anymore. You're just too small. Read that, you know, these big corporations, law firms, accounting firms, they want all the business, so they got the SEC to pass regulations against the small-time filers like me, who actually were the first in the system. The same happened with investment advisors. Back a long time ago, I was an investment advisor until the SEC made a rule that investment advisors could not be investment advisors unless they managed $20 million or more in assets. So I lost that. It's sort of like it professionalized. The big dogs saw the big money in it, so they got the SEC to pass regulations to get rid of the small-time players like me and other people who were out there in my arena. But anyway, the EDGAR system now stands for all filings. EDGAR search tools from SEC.gov. This is the origin of financial statements you'll see anywhere on the web. Yahoo, Google, even Standard & Poor's, NetAdvantage, a heavy, heavy site, pulls its big data from these EDGAR filings right here at the SEC. And I'll tell you something else. You got to be careful if you... I don't want to go to the SEC. I want to go to Yahoo Finance because I like Yahoo Finance. The problem is that the pulls that they do get numbers wrong. Sometimes there's persistent problems with the way the big data is pulled down, and so you'll see blanks that shouldn't be blanks. I didn't even realize this. About 3 years ago, I was doing one of these with financial statements from Yahoo because I didn't want to go to EDGAR, and I saw zero for the interest expense. And I thought, okay, zero, earnings before interest and taxes divided by interest, that's zero. And then suddenly it occurred to me, well, wait a minute. I just looked at the balance sheet and they had a ton of long-term debt. How could they have a zero interest expense with all that long-term debt? So then I went to EDGAR. Sure enough, it wasn't zero. It was actually the interest expense lines for the past 3 years were big numbers. It's just that Yahoo pulled them down and it didn't pull down the numbers, so it put a blank there. The same was true with Google. And then I went to Standard & Poor's NetAdvantage. Standard & Poor's NetAdvantage had a blank there. So apparently something about the data pool was leaving numbers out. That's why you'll see me go to EDGAR's system all the time now. Besides, the statute of limitations is over, so I can go to the SEC and they won't bother me too much, I hope. Probably should have used one of your accounts to do this. You can type in a company's name here, or you can type in the trading symbol. And what was Netflix? NFLX. Now you got to be careful because if you type in a company name, you might get a couple of different possibilities. And then you might, I see that one. That one's the one I want. It might actually not be the one you want. It might be a parent holding company. It might be a subsidiary. It might just be a company that's similarly named. So you got to be careful. If you got the trading symbol, that's your best bet. Now, notice all these filings that they have. 10-Ks, 8-Ks, things like that. For example, let's see what this 8-K was about. Letter to shareholders. That looks formal. Huh, what the hell was that all about? This is an 8-K filing. See how short they are? They're just saying, okay, something happened that's not usual, so we have to say about it. Jeez. Well, that's interesting. Notice how conservative they are. They filed an 8K with the SEC to tell the SEC that they're about to file their 10Q. Wow, someone's making $50 fast. Sorry, I'm thinking personal terms. Okay, notice the K. This is the big dog. And notice that this is very recent. So in other words, they've just pushed this thing out the door very, very recently. And you'll see these 8Ks, Qs, Def 14As and Def As. Always be careful. If you see a 10K, oh, I found a 10K down here. Look up further for another 10K, but also look for, make sure that there's not a 10K/A. That would be an amendment. They did something, screwed up something in their original 10K, or the SEC bit them in the butt for something they did in their original filing, so they're filing an amended 10K. So always make sure that there wasn't a 10KA after the 10K, because it might have something in it that's kind of like important. Yes, we overreported earnings by 800%. Anyway. A lot of arcane forms. What the hell is an 8A, 12BA? Good grief. Anyway, enough of that. Look, best way to do this, type 10-K. Search for that. There's your dinner. Now, this is the coolest part about this. This is so nice. Because now the SEC, and they've been doing this for some time now, allows you to pull an interactive, so that you can go through and you can look at these financial statements one by one. Very nice stuff. Very cool. Even more extremely cool is that you can download an Excel file that has all of that stuff in it. And then you can play with it. You can set up your ratios. You can print it out and put it on the refrigerator so mom is really impressed with what you're doing here. You know, is there some reason this download sucks? Oh, there it is. Now, first of all, enable editing. Okay. And you're going to see a bazillion tabs. And, you know, this is just stuff. Stuff. Here we go. Income statements. Otherwise known as consolidated statements of operations. That's your income statement. Now, here's where we need to talk a little bit. And I've already said this. You've already gotten a few of you sent me email messages confused by it. Companies use different words for the same thing. And you got to know sort of like, you know, you have friends. What's your first name?
Lonnie.
You have friends who call you Lonnie. You have friends who call you Lon. You have friends who call you asshole. You have friends who call you in the middle of the night. Okay? Now, you see, same thing. It's you. I mean, with that soul patch action going on, look at that shit. You know? But at the same time, I would talk. Come on, let's see it. Let's see it. Oh, you got a little tiny one right there. Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Flavor saver. Uh-huh. Where the hell was I? Okay, but you see, this could be called the income statement. It could be called the profit and loss statement. It could be called the consolidated statement of operations statement. But whatever it's called, it's your income statement. And typically, you'll have, for SEC, you'll have 3 years of income statements. Interestingly, back in the day, they required more years. And the balance sheet, when we go over to the balance sheet, you're going to see that they require only 2 years of balance sheets, which kind of makes for a pain in the butt when you want to do longer term trend analysis and stuff like that. You ain't going to have it happen. Okay. But anyway. Well, look at, here's some of the things that I was talking about. Let's look at the most recent. Notice that this company, unlike many, has a fiscal year that ends on the calendar year. Boy, I love that. It just makes, I don't know why, it's just some karmic thing for me. But look, you got revenues. And then you have your cost of revenues. Now, they do not break down the gross income line. But you see, revenue minus cost of goods sold, notice cost of revenue is cost of goods sold. Again, a variant, but it's the same thing. If you take revenue minus cost of revenue, that should be gross income. That should be gross in. That's your gross. But they don't break out that line. Some companies do. They don't. There's no absolute rock-solid reporting rule, and that's one of the things that drives me crazy, because sometimes, okay, what I would do right away on this income statement, before I do anything else, I would put in a gross income line. Because it's one of those lines that is actually kind of important to us. Okay? Because I'm kind of interested in that line. Because you see, revenues could be going up, but if my cost of revenues is going up faster than my revenues, then that's going to erode my sales. So I can say, wow, look how fast revenues are going up, but I might be a little less excited if I see that the gross income isn't going up nearly as fast as revenues are, because that tells me that they're paying more for the intermediate goods that they use in their production of their goods and services. But there you go. That's that line right there. Now, all of these, see how all of these are more like generalized expenses. You can't attach them to a product. That's why they fall below the gross income line. Those are those ones that, like I was telling you in my company, ink, paper. I can't say, well, I spent exactly this much ink to produce this thing that you see that I sold. It doesn't work that way. Marketing. How can you can't attach how much I spent for this marketing campaign that went into this product I sold. The same is true with technology and development. General and administrative, that's the SG&A that I had told you about before. That's your salaries, your wages, light bills, paper clips, and all of those other things are in that line. And then we come down to operating income, which would be gross income minus all of these SG&As. That's operating income. The other name for operating income, do you remember what I told you the other name is for it? You remember?
Income from operations.
No. That was a good bluff, though, man. That was decent. You know? I don't think it's going to work at that financial singles bar. You're still going to go home alone. Okay. Which is just as well. Netflix has great movies. Okay. It's called Earnings Before Interest and Taxes. EBIT. Operating income is the same as EBIT. EBIT. Okay? EBIT is operating income. It is how much you have right before you pay your interest and your taxes. And not surprisingly, then you go down here and you say, all right, this is how much they paid in coupons and interest on debts of different kinds. That's their interest. Now, they're going to put in some other things in here, too. There might be some positive numbers if they earn interest from stuff that they invest in. They might throw in some other stuff in here, too. This is a little more complex than you might see. They put in loss on extinguishment when they pay off debt. They might have to pay an extra amount of money to kill off a debt, and that might show up in this. That, like I said, this is actually kind of a little bit more complicated than you often see, but you will see the interest expense line, and then you'll see some interest that might come from stuff that they have invested in or things that they actually have to pay interest on that aren't typical classical instruments and all that kind of stuff. And then you get down to EBT. Earnings before taxes. Don't let that income taxes fool you. They're just trying to bluff you. That's EBT right there. Earnings before taxes. And then they come down to the provision for taxes. Now that's a provision. That's how much you're putting aside. That doesn't mean that's how much they have paid. That doesn't mean how much they will pay. That's how much they are putting down as a number, just a number for what they think their tax bill is going to be. Really quickly, just out of curiosity, if I took their most recent provision for income, 82,570, and divided that by taxable income, and that's what EBT is, taxable income. 349,369. Netflix has an average tax rate of about 23.63%. That's average. Of their earnings that are taxable, they pay an average of 23.63%. That would tell me that they're in the 34% marginal tax bracket. The last dollar they earn is getting taxed at about 34%. Remember that the marginal tax rate is always above the average tax rate. And then the final line, net income. Net income is the residual that belongs to the shareholders. They have paid their bills in a timely manner. Their debt holders, those people who have the prior claim, have been satisfied for the time being. And now we have this net income number, which is what the shareholders can claim. They can claim it through dividends and or plow back into the company that raises the price of the stock. In the case of Netflix, we see that they pay no dividend. So every penny on that line there, in an accounting sense, is going right back into that company. And that would be in thousands, $266 million is going right back into the company. Now, these are the, you divide by the number of shareholders, and that's each shareholder's claim. And remember I told you about that fully diluted, the diluted? That would be if all those options and things like that were exercised, there'd be more outstanding stocks, so we divide by that bigger number. That would be like a worst-case scenario, okay? Oh, shut up. Must be an emergency of some kind, okay? And this tells you, over the course of the year, this would be about the average of how many shares. Remember, shares are being sold all the time. Options are being exercised. Shelf registrations make shares come into existence. So you would, this is kind of like, on average, this was how many shares were out there. So in other words, if I took 266,799 and divided by 60,078, that would be where I get that $4.44 per share. That's where that would come from. Excuse me. Now, then you've got your balance sheet. Well, let's keep working here. Really? That's cash flow. Balance. There it is. What can I say about it? It's got all kinds of interesting information, stuff that we might need to know about. By the way, notice sometimes you get this odd burst of characters. That's what happens when the Edgar system can't read a character that has been entered by the company's Edgar filing agent. You get these weird little characters in there. They really did mean something at one time. That one looks like that was the possessive apostrophe, in case you ever wonder about something completely useless to know. But there you go, current assets, long-term assets, total assets, and then you got your liabilities and all that kind of stuff. And we can go through all of those wonderful things, paid in capital and the par value, add those together, that's the total capital. Now, let me switch over here. First formula that is absolutely important for you to know. And in fact, I think after you know this formula and I show you an example or two of it, I'm going to encourage you to just try some of this at home tonight when you have nothing better to do with your life, and you'll see what I'm talking about with some of these formulas. But the first one I want to show you, the first formula is actually not a finance formula per se. It's actually a math formula, but it is so important to us in business in so many ways. In science, it's important. In business, in any kind of quantitative subject. Madam, you have $2 for dinner tonight. I'm going to give you another dollar. That's right. You can get a happy meal. I know, right? Madam, you have $100 for dinner tonight. Here's a dollar. No, don't thank me, really. Do you understand that the absolute level of money is irrelevant to us? In the real world, I've just increased your dinner by 50%. I've just increased your dinner by 1%. It's not the absolute change that matters. It's the relative change. So if I were to tell you a company's revenues went up by $5,000 last year, you would know nothing. If that was Walmart, oh, that's awful. But if it's my piss-ass little company, that's unbelievable. You see what I mean? So in the world of business, as in science, we care about this wonderful little formula right here. Percent change. It's the ending value minus the beginning value. All of that divided by the beginning value. And then you times it by 100%, 100, to make it a percentage. It is probably the most useful formula because it takes you out of the world of absolutes so that you can see things in relative contrast. Now, what does that mean? Going back to the financial statements, let's roll back to the beginning here. There we go. Let's look at Netflix. What has happened to its revenue? The percent change, 12 to 13, and the percent change from 13 to 14. Let's see what these percentage changes were. So, and I want you to do this with me to make sure that you do it because it's easy to make a calculation mistake. Always put that numerator in parentheses. Always do that. Okay. Now, if I did that for 2000, the first one, I'd do the ending 4374. 4374 562 Oh, you open parentheses first. 4374 562 -3609 282. Close the parentheses, divided by 3609, 282, and you get, timesing it by, first times it by 100%, then round it to two decimal places. Two decimal places. If you give me one decimal place, three decimal places, or if you try to impress me by showing me that your calculator can calculate to 10 decimal places, I will eat your butt. And most of you do not have flavor. Anyway, let's not do that. Twenty-one point 20% So in other words, the growth of revenues. Oh, I'm just testing your ass to see if you're paying attention. There. 21.20%. Is that right? Yeah. Okay. So, now let's go and see what happened in from 13 to 14. From 13 to 14, we would take 5504, open parentheses, 5504656 minus 4374562, close the parentheses, divided by 4374562. Howdy. And then times that by 100. The growth rate, what do you get for it? The growth rate of revenue is accelerating. That's where the risk is coming. You saw how risky this company is? Its growth rate of revenue is accelerating. That means that this company is growing even at 21%, that's blistering growth rate. And now you've got it up to 25.83%. That's even scarier. That is a high growth rate company. And that means that it is a highly risky company. But let's do one real quick last thing here. Let's get these kind of like calculations. We'll do calculations the next time, and I'll bore the hell out of you with them. But I do want to show you something. Statement of cash flow. Let's get to their cash. Okay, cash and cash equivalents. End of year. For the most recent year, they have $1.13 billion in cash. Now let's be real financial analysts. They got $1.1 billion in cash. Why the hell are they borrowing $1.5 billion? Well, it says what they're going to do is use that money, or most of it, to buy back their own stock from stockholders. So what will that do to the price of Netflix stock as they buy back the stock? It'll increase it. That's why the stock price is increasing now. The markets are already impounding this potential for a buyback of stock. But wait a minute, that still doesn't explain. Why don't they just use their cash to do that? Why are they borrowing money, which makes them riskier because, you know, you've got more risk when you borrow. You're not going to be able to pay back the money. Why are they borrowing $1.5 billion when they could just use the cash that they've got on hand to do a lot of this? They don't have to borrow nearly that much. Why are they doing it that way? Think about this. One, they're borrowing. That makes them a riskier company. Two, they're buying back their stock. That makes their stock price go up. Three, they're hoarding their cash. Four, what are they doing? Come on, think. Why the hell? Yeah? Sounds good to me. They're hoarding cash because, one, they're going to make themselves, their stock expensive so that if their little thing that they want to take gets a white knight that comes after Netflix, it's going to have a huge thing to swallow trying to bite Netflix off at the pass. The stock price will be too high for a white knight protecting the target to go after. Netflix has debt, which would make it even less appetizing to a hostile predator white knight protecting a smaller company or protecting another company, and Netflix has cash on hand, so it doesn't have to go to bondholders and say, may we borrow money to do a hostile takeover? Bondholders don't much care for that. But if they go and they do tell the bondholders, we're just borrowing money so we can buy stock, that's another deal. Oh, by the way, we're keeping cash on hand because we're going to use the cash. No one has to ask, we don't have to ask anyone permission to use our shareholders' cash to do what they're going to do. My guess, well, this is just my guess. You see that kind of a strategy? Debt going up makes them riskier. Buying back their own stock makes their stock very expensive for a hostile takeover from a predator. And they're keeping cash on hand to go after something out there that's vulnerable, that they want, and they don't want that vulnerable target to go crying to a white knight that's big enough to go after Netflix and eat it up in the attack. Who is it? That's the question. And that's where we can actually have an edge. In normal stock trading, you got nothing. Those guys are as big as you are, but right now, From what I can tell, no one knows what's going on, but there is a general suspicion that Netflix is out there looking for something to eat, and it ain't cheeseburgers. That's all I have for you. Go home.